It is a state capitol report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A bipartisan package of bills aims to improve the security of judges and to reduce threats. As the Wisconsin Supreme Court Marshal's Office documents threats against judges and justices in the court system, be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share thoughts at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Paul Grimm is a professor at Duke Law School and director of the Bolsch Judicial Institute, served as a United States District Court judge for a decade. Paul, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So the Wisconsin Supreme Court Marshal's Office reports 142 threats were directed at judges and justices in 2023. Are threats and acts of violence becoming more common for judges nationwide?
I think the trend that you just described in Wisconsin is similar to the trend that's occurring on the federal level, and I would suspect in other states as well. In 2022, the United States Marshals Service reported 311 threats that they had investigated and verified as legitimate threats. And in the first 3 months of 2023, there were 280. So if you have 311 substantiated threats in 2022 and 280 in the first quarter of 2023, you can see that that trend is pretty much what's going on across the country in the state level and also at the federal level as well.
You say substantiated threats. How do states go about reporting these type of statistics or keeping track of this, around the country?
Well, that's a great question because obviously the judicial system depends upon law enforcement agencies that are devoted to judicial security to be the ones who will look into and investigate threats and then determine whatever level of threat is involved and provide appropriate security. In the federal system, it's the United States Marshals Service. In a state system, it could be the state police. It could be some other security agency within law enforcement within that state. But of course, in order to do their jobs, they need to have adequate resources. And when you have that large a number of threats that you just made reference to, imagine the number of law enforcement personnel that have to be available to try to investigate. And then if you have one where there's a serious threat, and there have been many of those, and of course, Wisconsin had its own tragic events occur recently when retired Judge John Romer from Juneau County Circuit Court was shot and killed by a former litigant who he had sentenced to a case. And so it's not just that there are threats made, but that those threats are being acted on. And that's happening with increasing frequency as well.
Why do you think is the judiciary increasingly under attack?
So that's a great question. And it's a complicated question with a lot of different factors that have played out to get us to where we are. The first thing you have to realize, and this is the National Center for State Courts every year tries to have surveys to get a sense of what's going on. And for over a decade, public opinion in the state and federal judiciary, which has typically been very high, one of the highest level of public acceptances for the judicial branch as compared with the legislative and the executive. But it's been eroding over the last decade or so. It's tied at times to the public's perception of the Supreme Court. But what happens is that the most recent annual survey done by the National Center for State Courts found that you have to keep in mind that the overwhelming majority of the American population has virtually little to no contact with the judicial system. Hmm. So maybe they got a parking ticket or they had a domestic issue that got them in court or were charged with a misdemeanor, or maybe they served on a jury trial. But the number of jury trials in state and federal courts are really declining. So they don't have a whole lot of personal contact with it. So that's number one. Number two, civic education, which for years has been an important way of teaching through secondary school and then high school and college, people of the American public about their government institutions so that they have knowledge of them and respect for them has declined. And so we have a much greater degree of civic illiteracy. So efforts to try to help the American public understand the system. And third, we have to realize is that with political polarization occurring in state and federal, in the federal legislatures, it is something that you hear that almost all issues become, have an aspect of politics behind them. And when there are disputes, when parties don't agree, and legislatures can't pass laws that resolve issues, they go to the courts. And so the courts are being tasked with deciding cases involving the most controversial issues in our society. And when those cases are decided, when so many people are split 50-50 about things, you're going to have large numbers of people who are upset. But I think what really has caused the increase is the ability for social media platforms to pick up attacks on judges and judiciaries and to amplify them, magnify them, send them through social media sites that people tune into. And they're not necessarily accurate. They're not necessarily intended to be fair and balanced. They have an ulterior purpose. And finally, it's becoming more and more frequent for people who have been involved in litigation and don't like the outcome to go on publicly and personally attack and vilify the judge, not saying that it was a poor result and they would appeal and they thought they would win, but to personally attack. And you saw examples of that from former President Trump making many comments about the judges in his many cases. And just last week, Elon Musk, who had an adverse ruling from a chancery judge in Delaware that stripped away a rather substantial $56 billion salary package that his company had given to him, Tesla. And he referred to her as an activist and politician first and foremost. So when someone like Elon Musk says that and puts it out over X, which used to be Twitter, and people don't know much about the judicial system because they don't have contact with it, and they read things like this, then their thoughts and they lose respect for the judiciary. They get angry about a decision, and because
it's an entree for that behavior to be repeated elsewhere. I'm just going to take a moment here to reintroduce you, Paul Grimm, with us, professor at Duke Law School, as we discuss judicial security and many details and aspects of it. You can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Paul, Republican lawmakers here in Wisconsin, they recently proposed a package that's aimed at curbing threats and violence. The bills propose restricting access to judges' personal information, like a home address. How do these measures help protect judges and justices?
Well, I think one of the things that they do, which is fortunate, is that when it's so easy to find out so much information about people by going online, when you can find the home address of a judge by going into the property records and finding the address of their house, then that makes it easier to, if you're upset, to try to go to their house and to do something there that would be either intimidating to the judge or possibly physically harmful. And Judge Romer's case, of course, is a tragic example of that. The same thing happened recently in Maryland, where a state judge was killed in his driveway by the aggrieved husband that didn't like a ruling that the judge had made in a custody case. So when you can't get that information and you can't then post that information so others have it, then it's a level of security that gives protection to judges that if they didn't have that would make them more vulnerable.
Paul Grimm, Duke Law School professor, director of its Bolsch Judicial Institute. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As state lawmakers circulate a bipartisan package of bills focused on judicial security, we examine what is fueling the threats of violence and its incidents directed at judges. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Duke Law School Professor Paul Grimm, who's a retired U.S. District Court judge for the District of Maryland. Paul, one bill would ban protesting outside a judge's home with the intent to interfere in the judge's duties. And there was a legislative hearing in January where the bill's author said courthouses are the appropriate place to protest. Do you think, does the bill raise First Amendment concerns for you?
Well, anytime you have a bill that does something like that, you always have to balance the right of the public to peaceably assemble and to get redress for their grievances. And demonstrations, peaceful demonstrations that do not disrupt government services in front of courthouses and other public offices have been a protected First Amendment right. So the efforts to try to balance the need to have judicial security so that judges are not intimidated by having their houses surrounded by people who, even if they're being peaceful, being out there and having them present has an impact on that judge's feeling of security and privacy of their home. If you have it at a public place like the courthouse, that's sort of the public square that traditionally has been a greater area for protections of First Amendment. So you have to try to get a balance. It sounds like that's what the bill has tried to do. And of course, if someone wants to challenge it on First Amendment grounds, they certainly can do that. And it would go to a court to decide whether or not that balance was properly drawn.
Wondering if these threats are discouraging, lawyers from pursuing these positions. State Representative Ron Tussler of Harrison, who is an author of the bills, said in a statement that if judges are deterred from serving due to potential risks to their personal safety, the very foundation of our legal system is at risk. What do you make of that viewpoint?
It's a legitimate concern. The National Center for State Courts that I referred to a while ago had an article that they came out with recently about the state of the court addresses given by state Supreme Court justices, similar to the one that the Chief Justice does every year. Mm-hmm. And a number of those, the justices have commented that it's getting increasingly difficult to get as many applicants for judicial vacancies as they used to have. You already have a significant difference between what the judges would earn as a judge as opposed to being in private practice or even government service. So that's a disincentive for many because the best people who you would want to be on the court may not be able to afford the restriction on their income by that. And if on top of it, they believe that themselves or their families may be threatened, that will possibly deter. And some of the numbers reflect that there have been decreases in the number of really best qualified people applying. It's a correlation. Does it show causation? We don't know, but it is a correlation. And that's an observation, I think, that raises legitimate concerns.
There was a survey by Pew Research Center in 2022 finding broad skepticism among adults in the U.S. Supreme Court justices' ability to avoid political influence. How warranted are these doubts about the fairness of judges and justices?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that no one, and certainly not myself, is saying that judges are above criticism. They're public officials. They have very significant roles that they play, and they have a great deal of authority. But I think that what you have to balance is that the judges that I have seen and worked with, and I believe the overwhelming majority of judges, work very, very hard to try to not let whatever their personal, political, and social beliefs are influence their decisions. The key to keep in mind is that judges have to show their work. unlike a lot of other professions that just may come out and do something, judges have to explain their reasoning. And if you're a trial court judge, your reasoning is subject to being reviewed by an appellate court, and appellate courts are subject to being reviewed by the Supreme Court. And so judges show their work. You also have to keep in mind that judges are asked to decide the most contentious, disputed, and polarizing issues in our nation. And when you have a nation that's divided 50-50 on almost every topic, whoever doesn't like that outcome is going to naturally challenge the outcome and argue that it's politically motivated. But I think that judges, more than any other profession that I'm aware of, work extremely hard to make sure that they do not let their personal beliefs influence their decision, and they have to explain their judgments. And if you look at that, and they justify it based upon legal grounds, you can disagree with those legal grounds, but I don't think it's fair to necessarily turn around and say they're politically motivated.
And, you know, that just begs, because we have here Republicans asking for State Supreme Court Justice Jana Protasiewicz to recuse herself from hearing cases over state legislative maps. That is based on comments she made during her campaign, calling the maps rigged. So, you know, she refused to step aside, and the new election map redrawing, that process is underway. How could that type of partisan disagreement affect the judicial branch?
Yeah, it's complicated, I think, because in many states, their judges are elected. And the electeds are contested. Many, many years ago, when I first started, it was even in states like Maryland where judges were elected, it was almost never a circumstance where there were contested elections. It's very, very frequent now. And when you're in an election and you're running, and you're trying to you know, address the voters and convince them that you're the best candidate, you're going to say things. And so that's a complicating factor that you don't get in the federal system or in states where the judges are appointed. Each state and each in the federal government have judicial codes of ethics. They have clear guidelines about recusal, and cases that sort of set forth the parameters of when you should recuse and when you should not. And each judge has to decide for themselves. Initially, whether or not they think they need to recuse themselves, if they don't, then of course there are judicial disability mechanisms in every judicial system where a complaint can be filed, and you have others that can take a look at it. And if they believe that the judge should have recused, they can order that. So there are checks and balances there that apply in cases where. They might be close issues, but I agree with you. In states where judges are elected, you know, it would not be for the good of the public if they had such a gag order on what they could say that the public couldn't be informed about what the judges are thinking to make an intelligent choice. So it's, again, one of those lines. It's a delicate line to try to find the right balance around.
Talking about judicial security with Paul Grimm, professor at Duke Law School. You can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Paul, what about the State Bar Association and you know, these associations' responsibility to defend against attacks on judges and on the courts? How should bar associations respond?
That's a great question. The American Bar Association has model codes. A model code of professional responsibility. Many states have adopted those code provisions verbatim. Some of them sort of modify them, but they're very broad-based. It's a good measure of what ethics obligations are on lawyers. And there's one, Rule 8.2, that deals with the relationship of the bar to the courts and judicial officers. And comment 3 to that says that lawyers are encouraged to fulfill their traditional duty of speaking out in defense of judges and the judiciary when unfairly criticized. Now, again, I say that no one's saying that you can't criticize the judiciary or judges, but when you make personal attacks on them, you've gone too far. When that's been done, it's been effective. So New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy, who was not pleased with a decision by U.S. District Judge Renee Bum, applying Second Amendment law and enjoining a state law that had been passed regarding gun control, referred to her as a right-wing activist. And the New Jersey Bar Association responded respectfully but accurately and pointed out that the judge had followed what the Supreme Court law was and tried to apply it, and that the criticism was unfair. And ultimately, the government came back, governor came back, and his office said that they respected the decision and that they knew that they were bound by it. They would appeal and that they meant no disrespect for the judge. So,
yeah. Well, Paul, thank you for that example. Thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure.
Paul Grimm, Duke Law School professor. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is projected to become warmer and wetter due to climate change, triggering a cycle of flooding, property damage, and rebuilding. A bill headed to the governor's desk aims to tackle root causes of flood-prone areas. Call in with a question. You can share thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Republican Representative Lauren Oldenburg of Viroqua represents the 96th District, including Westby and Prairie du Chien, along the Mississippi River. Representative Oldenburg, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me, and glad to be here on this beautiful winter morning, but it feels more like spring to me.
Yeah, yes, it does. Well, let's look at this Senate Bill 222, placing the measure to Governor Evers' desk. You know, the bill would establish two types of grants to help flood-prone communities. You sponsored this bill and call it a monumental change. How do you envision the grants would help communities?
Well, this bill got started about 2.5-3 years ago, meeting with the heads of agencies, and especially working with the Town Association, Chart Unlimited, and a Wetland Association, came up this idea of to look at issues that happen on flooding on a consistent basis. So my idea how it's going to be used to say if you have a bridge or a culvert that keeps getting washed out on these 100-year flood issues events, that, okay, what do we need to keep that road or keep that water crossing in place at these events? And so the first half of that grant, it's split in two ways, would to study the situation, maybe an H&H study, what causing the water to flow in a different area and stuff like that. And the second half of that grant would actually go in and fix those issues. And this program goes through the Wisconsin Emergency Management, does not go through the DNR. And that's kind of the idea we had behind here. It's like, save money in the long term. And that's why we created this bill. It's not, I don't believe it's being done throughout the country. Great idea, I thought. And also Wisconsin Emergency Management will actually, I heard that they'd be able to leverage some maybe federal funds through this program also to these high-prone flooding events and try to save money in the long term.
As you study the situation through this legislation, there's inventory work I read. You know, why does a culvert inventory need to be done?
Well, I've heard the extreme numbers of how many water crossings and culverts we have. With these events, the culverts might not be large enough, might not be long enough to take some of these rain events, and that's why we have washouts. So we need that inventory and see what's out there, so we know as legislators that what kind of dollars we're really talking about at these crossings, and maybe some of these crossings aren't needed as much as before. So we're trying to look at these valleys and these coulees and where the water runs at a big picture, so that we know what to do in the future and try to do it once and do it correctly.
The Wisconsin Wetlands Association said you gathered a group of organizations and agencies to advise ways to help rural flood-prone communities. What did you learn from this approach, this process to crafting legislation?
Yeah, this idea all started down at Timber Cooley. We met with when the bridge was washed out, I believe it was in 19, the Butman area. And I brought in the DOT, DNR, and the local officials. And from there, I facilitated a meeting down in Madison and brought in County Association, Town Association, DNR, DOT, Wetlands, Trout Unlimited, and there's a couple other ones too. And found out in the process, the agencies aren't talking to each other, especially the DOT and DNR. And that's where, and I guess, you know, I had a couple meetings with them and I said, and they've continued that discussion. So especially the DNR and DOT need to talk on, especially on these water crossings, that what's really going on here. And that's what I found out about that process when we got together, that there's not a lot. They weren't calling the phone, picking up the phone and calling each other. And I think that's where this idea and what I learned out of that when we got together, that there's got to be better communications among agencies, especially on these flooding events.
Would this legislation help patch up that communication, any communication breakdowns between the State Transportation Department and the State Department of Natural Resources?
It could. I don't know. I think this bill actually goes with maybe toward to the towns and counties and the local municipalities where these flood events goes, because that's who's actually going to be applying for these grants.
Mm-hmm.
And to that communication's going on. And then when the study process, you know, the roads, you know, the engineering part of it, or what it takes to improve a water crossing, I think there's going to have to be some communication when they decide to design a plan to implement this. So I hope the communication goes on no matter if this bill is in place or not.
We're talking about a bill headed to the governor's desk that aims to help flood-prone communities. We have State Representative Lauren Oldenburg, Republican from Viroqua, sponsor of the bill. You can join in with questions and comments along the way. 800-642-1234. Representative, the measure would allow local governments to apply for grants that are capped at $300,000 per project for the purpose of gathering information to assess flooding vulnerabilities. What information would these governments be seeking through this piece of the grant?
Well, that's each grant application is going to be different because every crossing is different. So the biggest thing is when you apply for these grants and then do the study, any time, which I've learned through the process, if you make a bridge bigger or smaller, or a culvert bigger or smaller, affects everything downstream. And so you have to do a H&H study, which is very expensive. You know, counties and towns cannot afford that. So the idea of this is put money in there that, hey, that deterred a lot of these studies before. So, hey, they got some dollars here to actually implement that study and get it started. And a lot of these municipalities will be able to do some in-kind for like labor and machinery work too, to help set off their cost for these grants also.
And H&H study is the study of the movement of water. Is that correct?
Correct. Yep.
Yeah.
And effects it has.
And the effects. So as you look at those effects, what types of projects are important to reduce flooding?
Well, the idea is not so much reduce flooding. Kind of goes to my farmland preservation bill, is actually keep soil and water on the upper lands stuff. The main idea of this bill is actually the infrastructure of the road or the crossing, so it does not get washed out on every flood, the same floods or the same road, same culvert, same bridge getting washed out every time. We have to fix that. So some of this could be, you know, affecting the wetlands above it, you know, maybe restoring some of that wetlands. Maybe the creek or the has moved, so it's not hitting the center of the culvert or center of the bridge anymore. some of those ideas. So that's where the communication with the DOT and the DNR have to be working together and just say, hey, how can we fix this so it does not keep washing out? And so, yeah, it affects it. I think we'll reduce flooding, especially if we work on the wetlands above these washouts or these washout areas that are prone for it. So hopefully slows the water down, but a lot of that flooding has to be done maybe up on the land. Reduce the flooding is, you know, through keeping the water and the soil on the upper lands.
Do you think wetlands are a natural solution to flooding?
That's what they're created for. I mean, that's the idea. So we have excess water, so they have a place to go. And that's the ultimate way when we look through these valleys and stuff that, you know, water always runs downhill. So it's like, okay, how can we slow the slow the speed of the water? And when you have a 100-year flood, I truly believe you're not going to slow that water down much. So you have to slow it before it gets to the valley.
Lawmakers had set aside $2 million in the current state budget for a similar type of program. Would this amount of funding be enough to meet the demands from local communities to assess and reduce flood risk?
I don't say it probably is not enough, but hopefully when talking with putting this bill together with the Wisconsin Emergency Management that, you know, they thought like leveraging some federal funds through this program. We got the language down now. That's the big key part of it. You know, so they have the language, how it works. They create the grant program. So in going forward, the idea is, you know, I had to get my rest of my colleagues on board here. So we went for a number that we thought they would approve, and which they did. They put it in the budget, and the budget got signed. But going forward, every legislation, we will have to come back and ask for that dollars in the budget. So that's the idea, to get these programs out there, see if it's working, gather the data, and see what the best results we get for our money.
You have aligned to Republican Representative Lauren Oldenburg of Viroqua District on the western border of the state. Call in with a question. You can share your views at 800-642-1234. It is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss legislation moving through the Capitol and policy initiatives with Representative Lauren Oldenburg of Viroqua District in southwestern Wisconsin, sharing a border with the Mississippi River. Call in with a question. You can add your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You are the author of a bill that would make some changes to apprenticeship programs in Wisconsin, and the changes would include forming a $500 apprenticeship tax credit and expanding programs eligible for incentive grants and completion awards. Why make these changes to apprenticeship programs?
Well, the idea is, you know, we put this bill, similar bill, toward the last session and toward the end, and didn't get it through. So we came back this year, worked with the people that would affect, especially the trades. And the idea of it is to get more and more young individuals into the trade profession. So some of the hiccups, you know, and some of the roadblocks that we have out there in the youth apprenticeship and the registered apprenticeship is the cost. So give up. You know, through this bill, we give a tax incentive or a rebate back to them to maybe offset that initial cost, because there are some costs to going into these trades through clothing, shoes, tools, and stuff like that to maybe deter some people to actually go into trades. So we thought this was a good idea to actually maybe take some of those barriers away from for individuals going into the trades.
And your bill would create a youth apprenticeship completion award that can offer up to $1,000. The program, though, would only be available for youth apprenticeships in architecture and construction. Why limit a program to those two fields?
Well, we got to start somewhere. So hopefully, if it goes well in those two areas, we can come back and expand that to other areas. And but that's, I think, the reason those two areas is, I think we are finding they are more cost inhibitive as far as be able to individuals go in there, because it does cost the individuals, you know, clothing, tools and stuff to go in those trades a little bit more expensive than, say, a CNA or someone or in the finance end of it, because of, you don't have to have a lot of extra cost to as far as tools and clothes to go into those positions. So hopefully it goes well. If we get the bill passed and signed, then we can come back and maybe expand it into other areas.
You know, after the governor's recent State of the State address, you talked about appreciating Governor Tony Evers announcing new nurse and teachers apprenticeship programs. How else could lawmakers help to further destigmatize the trades?
You know, I think it's getting, I think it's nationally doing that because of the cost of higher education and the wages that some of these trades are getting now coming out of, you know, you go to youth apprenticeship, registered apprenticeship, then going to maybe a tech college to get that trade or go to work and they send you back. You know, by the time most individuals getting out of a college at 22, 23, 24 years old with a high debt, and these individuals already been in the workforce for 2 to 3 years, very little or if no debt, and making very good money for, especially in Wisconsin, especially rural areas. And they realize, wow, I mean, they're part of society, part of the already, they're, you know, buying homes, they're buying vehicles. And so I think it's already doing it on their own. I don't think it has to be us to change the what people look at trades, but I think that's has happened on their own because of the cost of higher education is getting so expensive that it makes it very attractive for young people to go into the trades.
Given those factors, given that type of climate, do you feel like the governor might have a different assessment this time with the legislation?
I think it's more, I don't know if the governor would have it. I think, you know, some people in, you know, in our caucus, in the Senate caucus, maybe has some issues with some unions, some tech college has some issues with a little bit. We'll see. It's hard to say. I think there's a lot into this bill that has to be maybe even worked out yet till before we get it finalized and cross the line.
What might be a sticking point?
Right now is the wage on one part of it, and then the technology has some issues, especially in the road building end of it. Over in Fox Valley, there's a, you know, who actually authorizes the apprenticeship. So those things that we're still working out. We're close. We'll see what happens.
We're talking about legislative priorities with Representative Lauren Oldenburg, Republican from Viroqua. You can join in questions and comments along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We're going to turn to farm preservation. You're the author of a bill recently signed by Governor Evers that updates the Farmland Preservation Program. And you've said you've been perfecting this legislation over 5 years. Why did this program need to be updated?
Well, they did a study in 2016, 2017 that found out that landowners and farmers were not signing up to do farmland preservation because they didn't think it was worth their time. And so we went after one of the biggest incentives was we were not getting enough money for the tax credits to do the work. And so they decided not to do it. So we raised the tax credits for to get more and more dollars back into the landowner that actually does farmland preservation. And the idea, yeah, it costs money, you know, $6 million and $5 million here for the next 2 years to just do the the cost for just increasing the tax credit. But the idea is getting more and more landowners to sign up and do this farmland preservation, because I think that's the ultimate goal here, is to, like I said before, keep the soil on the land and keep the water on the upper lands. And I think farmland preservation is a great start, and keeps the waters cleaner, keeps the phosphorus runoff from the farms to a minimum. So that's the idea behind this. And so I finally got it through after the third time, just because I think this is the right timing because of the cost of it, and for where we're at financially in the state of Wisconsin.
Is there, do you think, as you talk with your constituents, especially in farming, do you think there is a pull for farmers to sell their land to developers instead of keeping it in production?
I don't see that.
Okay.
I mean, I say maybe it could be around the bigger cities, you know, would drive that. But I think there is a good appetite for farmland out here just to be continue to farm.
The Wisconsin Farm Bureau Federation says the state is experiencing less interest in the program in recent years, as you mentioned. How else could lawmakers grow interest in the voluntary program?
There's one part of the bill that got taken out originally that was using DAC caps. Some extra dollars that they have is to help local counties to maybe put a part-time individual in place to actually help farmers and landowners to implement farmland preservation. And I would love to see that. Hopefully next legislation, if I'm back down there, to actually maybe try to put a bill and put that to through the legislation process and the governor's desk to actually put a grant program out for local county land conservation officers that they can hire someone, maybe two or three counties can go together and hire a full-time person to actually go out and help the landowners to get in farmland preservation.
Do you find that it is an issue that farmers might not have time to do a program like this unless there is outside help?
I see that's probably the biggest hiccup, because they've never done it before. Every 4 years, you have to re-up it. You got a soil test every 4 years. And soil test, no matter if you're in this program or not, I think it's a great tool for farmers that need to be used. And I think that is probably the time, you know, these farmers have gotten bigger, run more land. I think you need someone out there that has the expertise that can run a computer quickly and put all the information into the program. I think that would be to help to increase the acreage for farmland preservation.
Representative Oldenburg, thank you for joining us.
Anytime. I'm glad to be able to do this and inform your listeners.
Representative Lauren Oldenburg is a Republican from Viroqua, representing the 96th District, elected to the Assembly in 2018. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Milwaukee Bucks, they wrap up a five-game road trip tomorrow, taking on the Phoenix Suns before heading home to host the Minnesota Timberwolves on Thursday. So with new head coach Doc Rivers on the sideline, we check in and we hear from you. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Eric Naim is a senior writer for The Athletic, covering the Bucks, and author of 100 Things Bucks Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die. Eric, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with the coaching now under Doc Rivers. So how differently are the Bucks playing under Rivers versus Adrian Griffin?
Yeah, it's a fascinating idea. You talk to a lot of the players, and one of the things that we've heard over the last week in, this Bucks team is, as you mentioned, currently on a five-game road trip. So essentially what you've heard is this is a training camp in the middle of the season. And that is not what you want to hear when you have three games in four nights as you're trying to finish up a road trip. But, you know, when Doc Rivers took the job, you know, at his introductory press conference, he said, hey, there's probably four practices that we can have the rest of the season. Just looking at the schedule, there's probably the opportunity for four practices. One of those was on Friday in Dallas at Southern Methodist University. And that, like I said, it was right before three games in 4 days. And, you know, on Saturday, I think you saw the potential of that, as all the players after the game were talking about how, you know, there's a new thing that they wanted to do defensively that they installed on Friday at this practice. And then Saturday, it ended up working perfectly, and they were able to get a huge come from behind victory over the Dallas Mavericks. And that was great. And then you saw all of the energy that they had used in that practice, in the game on Saturday, and then trying to play again on Sunday here in Salt Lake City. They ran out of energy as the fourth quarter came around against the Utah Jazz, and they lost the game. So it's really fascinating, because there are, I'm sure, a lot of changes that Doc Rivers would like to make as the head coach of the Milwaukee Bucks. There just isn't a ton of opportunity to actually do that. So they are trying to change some things. I think defensively, they've looked quite a bit stronger since Doc Rivers has taken over. Offensively, they're trying to use a little bit more of Giannis Antetokounmpo and Damian Lillard together in, you know, two-man pairings, and trying to get that camaraderie between those two players and that chemistry growing a little bit. But thus far, it's you got to take these baby steps, because it's really hard to make a whole lot of changes in the middle of an NBA season.
Well, let's hear from Doc Rivers at a press conference after the Bucks lost their second game with him coaching. And here's Rivers talking about possession issues.
We've had these two or three stretches in every game where we just have bad offensive possession. And a lot of those bad offensive possessions are turnovers that lead to buckets. When you're playing at a thin line the way we are right now, until we get our defense right and things like that, those change the game.
So those change the game. What changes might Rivers consider as the team tries to make a deep run into the postseason?
Yeah, it's been fascinating to watch kind of what he's done, because when you look at this team, they were very good offensively before Adrian Griffin got fired. They were, depending on what metric you would use, a top five offense in the NBA. And I think a lot of people, including myself, expected Doc Rivers to come in and focus on the defensive side of the basketball. You know, the Bucks haven't been very good defensively this season. They sat around the 20th spot before Adrian Griffin was fired. And that they've been a top five defense for the last 5 years under Mike Budenholzer, and they've changed out some personnel and tried some new things. They have some new players. So some of those struggles were understandable, but a big part of bringing in a new coach was thinking about the defensive side. And it, to me, I have been a little bit surprised to see Doc Rivers go after the offensive end as much as he has, and to really try to do some new things. And, you know, those possession issues, you know, some of those turnovers, some of those wasted possessions, I think have come from Doc Rivers trying to figure out exactly how he's going to do things offensively. At the top of his list is getting Giannis and Damian Lillard on the same page. He feels like while those two players have been good, they are both going to be all-star game starters here in another couple weeks. They haven't been quite good enough. It's been good. It hasn't been dominant. And that's what he wants. He wants a dominant pairing from those two guys. And I think as he's really dug into it, he's struggled to make it work smoothly. And that includes the practice time issues that I talked about here at the start of our conversation. You know, it also includes the fact that both of those guys are used to being the very best player on their team, having the ball in their hands more than anybody else. You know, for essentially a decade, each of these guys was the engine, the reason behind a top 5 to 10 offense by themselves, just by themselves. That's what it was like. And now you're in a spot where you're trying to put them both together, and they're like, well, I can do this by myself. Why do I need this other person? And that's where you get some of these issues.
Oh, managing expectations. Eric Name with us, reporter at The Athletic, as we talk about the Milwaukee Bucks midseason. You can join in. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Well, let's talk about managing morale. Rivers has coached multiple teams with high expectations to be championship contenders. And here's center Brooke Lopez talking with reporters about Doc Rivers' debut as the Bucks coach.
He handled everything great. He did a good job making sure everyone was clear on their responsibility, what to do defensively, what to do offensively, you know, and there weren't any real hiccups. So, you know, he did a good job.
Okay, so positive sentiment. That's been echoed elsewhere on the team. You know, how are Bucks players feeling? What is the emotions like with the coach change?
Yeah, I think one thing you've kind of heard from them over and over again is he just kind of knows what he's doing, you know, and that's, I guess, to be expected of someone that's done the job for 24 seasons before joining the Bucks. So it's not a situation where, you know, I think with Adrian Griffin, he was put into a really tough spot. He was a first-time head coach in the NBA trying to figure out, you know, what he wants his own team to look like, what he wants his vision to look like, and then doing so with a team that has championship expectations, that has 5 championship players on it, that has a 7-time All-Star in Damian Lillard, that knows what he's thinking. And I just think throughout the year, you kind of heard them talk about Adrian Griffin and, you know, how they could help him along and, you know, how they could help him work with them. And I think one thing that has changed since Doc Rivers has taken over is that I don't think the players feel like they need to help Doc do all that much. There's none of the, you know, Doc doesn't quite know what he wants. I think Doc knows what he wants, and he understands the limitations of joining in the middle of the season. But I think overall it's just kind of been, all right, like, he's been through this before. You know, it's really hard to find a situation that he hasn't seen before because he's coached so many great teams. He's had high expectations. He's won a championship. You know, he's coached multiple All-Stars together. He's coached multiple great offensive players together. He's coached great defenses. He's done so much in his over 2 decades in the league that he just kind of knows how to get everything in place. He knows how to communicate his vision. And he knows how to get everyone on the same page. And I think overwhelmingly, that's just kind of been the message that we've heard from players is that, you know, there's just an organization to everything that they're doing right now. And that felt like something that was kind of lacking under a first-time head coach.
Eric Name is a senior writer at The Athletic covering the Milwaukee Bucks. And you can be part of the discussion at any point. Call in with a question. Share your perspective. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Milwaukee Bucks head coach Doc Rivers gets hired midway through the season, we check in with The Athletic's senior writer Eric Name, a Bucks beat reporter, and you can join the conversation along the way. Call in with a question, share your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Eric, can you go into why did the Bucks fire Adrian Griffin? What was going on inside the team?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is just the Bucks have really high expectations. I think they've shown that over, of course, the last 5 seasons, but certainly over the last 8 months, as you look at them getting rid of their championship head coach in Mike Budenholzer, as the team kind of fell in a first-round upset in the playoffs last year. And then again this year with a 30-13 record for Adrian Griffin, that wasn't good enough. And while that, I think, can be hard for people from the outside to sort of believe, because it was the second-best record in the NBA at the time. It was, you know, a lot of success for the team from a wins and loss perspective. There was just not enough progress for the organization to believe in what Adrian Griffin was doing. And the things that they were looking at specifically, first and foremost was the defense. And this is a team that traded – arguably its best defensive player for a great offensive player. Drew Holiday was a spectacular defensive point guard. They traded him for Damian Lillard, who's a spectacular offensive point guard. So you're going to have some of those changes are going to affect how you perform, obviously. So you make some of those changes, and I don't think anyone was expecting the defense to be as good this season, but I think the big thing was that as the season wore on, I believe the hope was from the organization that they're going to have these growing pains, and that's okay with a first-time head coach, but they still want to see the growth. And when you look at the month of January, they got to a spot where they just weren't growing defensively. That was their worst defensive month of the season. They're regularly giving up 130 points a night. And it was just a spot where you were hoping, the organization was hoping to see something building throughout the year, to build up from, all right, if we do start the season 20th in defense, you know, hopefully we get to 15th and then 10th and then maybe 5th. And maybe we'll never get that high, but we want to keep seeing that progress. And I just don't think the organization felt like they were ever really seeing that progress with Adrian Griffin. And first and foremost, that's the thing. The defense just not getting better as the season went on.
Do you think organizations are becoming less patient with coaches than years ago? I mean, Sports Illustrated doing the calculation here. Griffin's time as Milwaukee's coach is tied for the third shortest tenure of a full-time head coach in NBA history.
I mean, certainly when you look back on the history of the game, I think it's grown it's kind of crazy to think about the Milwaukee Bucks that a lot of people know from the 80s, you know, had a coach in Don Nelson that was beloved, never won a championship, but he still had the job for almost an entire decade from the late 70s into the late 80s. He was the Bucks head coach. He was beloved. He knew exactly what he was doing. Everyone was happy with being a consistent winner year over year over year, and they were always in the mix. You know, one year they would beat the Celtics and they'd lose to the 76ers. The next year they'd beat the 76ers, but they'd lose to the Celtics. And, you know, they never made that NBA Finals appearance, but everyone was pleased with the job that he was doing because clearly he put together good systems and, you know, they were winning games. And you think to kind of what you are thinking about now in this Bucks team, you know, in the middle of what ended up being a championship season in 2021, Mike Budenholzer's third season with the Bucks, the organization had real thoughts about firing him. You know, I remember covering that entire playoff run and, you know, watching the Bucks go down 2-0 to the Brooklyn Nets and starting to prepare my story for what happens when the Bucks lose and they fire Mike Budenholzer. And I remember the NBA Finals when they went down 2-0 again to the Phoenix Suns. And I looked back in my Google Docs and I was like, okay, what did I do with that file about firing Mike Budenholzer again? let me see if I can find that and make sure that, you know,
freshen that up a bit.
Right. Like that's the level of expectations that now exist in the NBA. And I mean, that's, you know, three decades, but that's what you're talking about. You're talking about, you know, the consistency of having the same coach and believing in that coach and knowing that he's good, even if he hasn't won a championship, to the high level pressure of being an NBA coach today, where even if you were, you know, in those three seasons that Mike Budenholzer had, the Bucks had the best record in the league the first two seasons. They had gone to an Eastern Conference Finals. They had been in the playoffs every year. That wasn't enough.
That so still might not be enough. Yeah, yeah. It's a contrast you set up.
100%.
Eric Naim, reporter at The Atlantic, as we talk about the Bucks and the new head coach. You can join in. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Jack in Madison is here. Jack, hi. What is your question?
Hey, good morning. Well, first of all, I just want to say I'm really happy to hear you guys talk about the Bucks on WPR. I know it may not be that big a deal to you guys, but it's just really happy to hear about that. And like, as often as the Packers are, like, of course, the Bucks are Wisconsin's other big team. Anyways, all that aside, I wonder how the Bucks run to the playoffs looks like this year, even if it's a little early to tell at this point because we're midway through the season. But, you know, we just got a new coach. And, you know, as the team kind of starts to regroup and gel around Doc Rivers, I wonder, like, what their chances are of making it, you know, to the finals are this year in light of the new coach and just this kind of shakeup that's occurred, you know, over the past couple of years.
Jack, thank you. Eric, set us up.
I mean, I think they have a real chance. You look at the talent on this roster, it is, you know, parallel to the other great teams around the league. They have a lot to figure out. I'm not trying to say that, but that's not something that is unheard of as far as, you know, coaches coming in their first year and winning a championship, you know, teams being able to gel quickly and do these things. There's been plenty of modern examples. You look at Steve Kerr with the Warriors in his first season, Nick Nurse in his first season with the Toronto Raptors a few years back. That's not something that is unheard of. So these things can happen quickly. I think you look at the talent base that the Bucks have. Giannis is, if not the best player in the league, one of the best players in the league. You look at what Damian Lillard, even though it hasn't quite been what he did in Portland, he's still put up spectacular numbers this year, and he's still one of the most clutch players in the NBA. That I think this Bucks team, while they are not firing on all cylinders right now like the Boston Celtics, you know, I think they're a team that has the talent to compete with the Celtics, and if they can figure it out, you know, should be right there with them in the Eastern Conference. You look at the rest of the East. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, can they figure out injury management, though? I mean, last night they didn't have Brooke Lopez or Chris Middleton.
Yeah, I mean, so obviously Brooke was out with some personal issues. There's no injury concerns there, so Brooke should be back shortly. Chris is a legitimate question. That's really difficult. As Chris has tried to come back, they haven't been able to play him on back-to-backs. Luckily, in the playoffs, there are no back-to-backs, but this is a team that is getting older, a championship team that, you know, has a lot of those guys that was around when they did it a few years ago, and now they have to figure out if they can do it again, if they have enough juice left in their legs to do it. So that is something that they will have to be concerned about and be thinking about, and obviously that's something that they're managing right now. But I don't know if those concerns are really something that can keep them out of the title picture and certainly contending in the Eastern Conference.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. This is fun.
Eric Naim. Yes, fun. Senior writer for The Athletic covering the Milwaukee Bucks. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Hundreds of public and private high schools make up the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association. We discuss the prep sports landscape and a division expansion underway for girls volleyball. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Stephanie Hauser is here, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association. Stephanie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Appreciate you having me, Kate.
So in recent days, the association approves adding a fifth division for girls' high school volleyball. Why does girls' volleyball need five divisions when boys' volleyball has one?
Well, that's a fair question. Right now, girls volleyball has about 430 teams across the state, whereas the boys have about 66 teams in the state. And so with that type of a imbalance, the boys are actually represented at a little bit of a higher percentage than the girls are, believe it or not, with only one division. Although we are excited about both because there's been growth in both sports with boys volleyball going up over 66 teams this next fall, and that's increased by about 10 teams over the past several years. So growth is good on both ends. We're excited about having more teams at the state championship to experience all that Green Bay and the Resch Center has to offer.
So why is volleyball having this moment? Why is it booming?
You know, I think that you see that popularity across all of the levels right now. You know, you saw this fall during the women's season, the NCAA season, viewership at an all-time high with record-breaking attendance. So I just think that it is a sport right now that has gained not only in participation interest, but also fan interest. So I believe that what we're seeing at the high school level is reflective of that.
So how does the association decide which schools belong in which divisions for volleyball?
That is by and large determined by the school enrollment. And that has been a means of determining divisional placement for basically for the entire history of the WIAA. Now, there are some other factors that can be included in that and take a look at your performance in recent tournament history. But by and large, it starts with the enrollment of the high school. So the girls volleyball with five divisions, again, the largest 112 schools in the state will be in Division One, and then Divisions Two, Three, Four, and Five will be divided equally with about 80 schools in each of the respective divisions.
Do you think, will you see a cap on this? I mean, do you think this trend, this growth that you're seeing in volleyball, will that continue, especially when you look at 430 teams with girls?
Well, we always hope so. Participation of student athletes is always the number one goal. So by continuing growth within the sports that we currently offer, such as girls and boys volleyball, is always a goal, but also adding new sports where we've seen interest, such as girls wrestling, which was added 3 years ago, and those numbers have grown exponentially. And then also girls and boys lacrosse, which will launch this spring. So the goal is getting kids connected with their high schools through participation on these athletics teams.
And we're going to talk about wrestling and lacrosse later. But with volleyball, is your Board of Control making any other changes to volleyball rules?
The rules of the sport itself are largely determined by the National Federation of High Schools. So the rules of the game, a rule book, so to speak, really isn't determined at the state level. That's determined at the national level. But all other related decisions, such as the addition of a division, things like that, are determined by the Board of Control. Melissa Gehring, who is one of our executive staff members who oversees the sport, has worked tirelessly over this past year to come up with new formats for the state championship, because certainly it has to change how it looks when you add four additional teams in. And so that state tournament itself will be expanded by a half a day. It will start on Wednesday afternoon and evening and continue with championships through Friday night and Saturday. And again, as you mentioned, those are finally approved by the Board of Control.
We're talking about high school sports with the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association. We have the organization's executive director, Stephanie Hauser, with us. You can join in with questions and comments at any point. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. So, Stephanie, the association's Board of Control approved plans for a new student leadership group. How will this group influence high school sports here in Wisconsin?
Well, we can't wait to see what the impact will be. One of our executive staff members, LeVar Ridgway, has worked over the past almost 2 years with our membership, gaining feedback from our athletic directors, principals, and superintendents to ask them, how can the addition of a statewide student leadership group help you and your school to do more and have more impact? Coincidentally, the National Federation of High Schools, I mentioned previously, also has launched a student leadership committee at the national level. So we really feel like that student voice is powerful. We can gain a lot of feedback from the students, and in turn, we believe we can offer better opportunities for the students because of the feedback they're providing. We plan right now to involve these students at the state level, give them some roles and responsibilities at our state championships, thereby exposing them to the multiple athletic, administrative, and related careers, sports marketing, statistics, communications, the media. Again, all that event management, we think that that's a great opportunity to expose those kids to that.
So is it like a way for students then to better understand the sports industry and how their sport works?
That is one of the primary goals of this student leadership council that we are forming, is to help expose them and give them a bigger understanding. If this is something that they have a passion for and they love, we want to expose them to understanding what else is out there. Being a professional athlete is just not an option for most kids, but staying involved in so many ways is an option. And this is an excellent way to let them know what's out there.
How are students picked to be in this role?
It will be an application and an interview process. Will involve members of the board, as you mentioned. Some of our executive staff will be involved. And then because this is the very first launch of it, we won't have students as part of the selection process. But in the future, we plan to have members of the council themselves be part of that interview team to select students. It'll be consisting of juniors and seniors. They'll have a two-year term on the council. And looking forward to the launch of it this spring with opening up that application process and selection process.
So the application and nomination start in March, is that right?
That is our hope, to have that application ready to go, yes. And we will be selecting a representative council from across the seven WIAA districts.
Let's take a call now. Lori is with us in Madison. Lori, hi, go ahead.
Hi. I've been involved with the grassroots level of volleyball all of my life. Played college myself and came from a very small rural hometown in Wisconsin. As I've grown, I've seen, my question is, currently WIAA does not allow scholarships, and I am concerned that across the country that is not the rule. I believe after reading our rules about 10 years ago that the rules are interpreted in a way that continue the disparities in our sport, and the sport needs to be inclusive of everyone. And I think there's a lot of people that want to see more equity in volleyball. And I was wondering if you would be looking at the rules across the nation to try to have ours be more in alignment with what is going on around the country in terms of everyone being able to participate more equitably.
Lori, thank you for that question. Stephanie.
Thanks, Lori. Appreciate your question. And certainly you're right. We want to do whatever we can in this office to help break down barriers that would prevent student athletes from being involved. One of the things that the membership will be taking a look at this spring is the use of name, image, and likeness. And again, amateur status is unique to high school sports. And that's what Lori is referencing, the not allowing students to receive scholarships to participate in athletics. And again, it comes back to the nature of and the philosophy of being an amateur athlete versus being a paid athlete. I do believe that the membership will be voting on name, image, and likeness this spring. It is it has moved through the membership for a lot of discussion over the past couple of years. And again, that would potentially open up some opportunities for student athletes to capitalize on their own name, image, and likeness and be able to gain some financial means related to athletics. Now, would that allow for scholarships per se? No, it would not directly, but it would open up some opportunities for student athletes for financial gain.
Is name, image, and likeness at the high school level, is that a way to retain athletes in a particular state? I mean, as you look at the landscape across the country and other states allowing it.
That has grown a lot in recent years. We are at about 30 of the 51 state associations that now have adopted some type of name, image, and likeness allowances. And so you're right, it has grown, Kate. We are looking at those states that have put the language in. We're looking at their language very closely. We're modeling our language that the membership will potentially be voting on this spring to look like what other state associations have done. Could it keep kids? Sure, it could. I don't know that we are losing many kids to other states because of name, image, and likeness restrictions at this time. But you're right, that could happen. That number could grow.
What are some other ways that could help improve equity in volleyball in particular?
Providing affordable ways for students to be involved. One of the things that I'm not sure, but maybe Lori is referencing to, is playing club volleyball, which can be very expensive. And that is not something that the WIA oversees, is the club sports. And so oftentimes I think that there are kids that can't afford that type of training. So what we encourage our member schools to do is offer affordable, free, or very, very minimal cost opportunities for student athletes to continue to grow and learn within that sport.
Stephanie Hauser leads the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association as we discuss topics related to high school sports. Call in with a question. You can add your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss issues and priorities in Wisconsin prep sports with the nonprofit Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association that organizes play for its hundreds of member schools. And we have the association's executive director, Stephanie Hauser, with us. You can join in, call in with a question, share your viewpoint, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Stephanie, the association's board of control discussed ongoing efforts last week to recruit and retain licensed referees. How is your group trying to address ref shortages?
It is a challenge, and it really peaked during the pandemic. Schools and our association saw, you know, all-time low numbers. Let's start with good news. The good news is we are seeing that our number of licensed officials is back up to pre-pandemic numbers. We have a goal of 10,000 licensed officials, and we're at that. So that's the exciting part of it. But let's also be realistic. We were already in a shortage situation prior to the pandemic, so we're still there. I think the biggest piece that's changed that is very encouraging to us is we are now seeing efforts by everyone. They've embraced that this is all of our challenges, not just the WIAA. We can't do it alone. We need schools. We need officials of associations. We need conferences. We need adults, coaches, and fans in the stands. We need everyone on board to help us not only recruit new officials, but to keep the ones we already have and to retain those. So it is a continued challenge. One of the biggest things we've seen as of late that's exciting is we have so many high schools now that are offering courses to their high school students to get licensed. So our number of licensed high school students is over 1,200, and that is very encouraging about the future and what's to come.
So do you think, though, high school students can give some relief, can be an answer to this shortage? I mean, these are young people out there officiating games.
It is certainly, again, it's hope for the future. What the schools are doing is primarily using those high school students at their middle school games or on the weekend tournaments to try to give them that exposure and that experience that they need. It does not give them immediate help for working junior varsity and varsity level contests. Mm. Those are still, you know, officiated by licensed officials who are adults. But again, it is getting those kids the exposure and the understanding of how this all works and start training them early. The number one reason that officials get into and stay in the professional officiating is the relationships. So helping those kids network and build those connections early is really key.
WGBA-TV talked with the president of the Green Bay Officials Association last football season about the shortage. And let's listen to Tim Marquardt talking about the negative criticism officials face.
We lose a lot of officials who succumb to the negative feedback that they get during play. We've had people who've gotten followed to their car, or, you know, where somebody will say, I'm going to see you after the game.
Is the solution to the state's referee shortage about sportsmanship? Is it about paying referees more money? What do you think of those types of issues?
The National Level Officials Association, NASO, just recently completed a survey with tens of thousands of officials from across the nation responding. And the number one reason that they say that they leave the profession is because of is negative adult behavior. And that includes the fans in the stands, the coaches. So it indeed is a challenge. The amount that they're being paid is a concern. It is a factor, but it is not the number one. Most officials do it because they love it. They do want to be compensated for their time, but it's not about the money for them. It's about the love of the game and giving back. So certainly Tim hit it right on the head. That is the reason why officials are discontinuing their licensing.
It is, I would imagine, though, difficult to control that type of behavior and any types of threats. You know, what is your position on that?
Well, when it comes to the school-affiliated athletics, we rely heavily on the school leadership to have a solid event management plan, which includes crowd security, officials liaison, someone who will be with the officials as they leave the court, as they come onto the court, and yes, sometimes even to walk them out to their car, depending on the situation. But again, having those plans in place, and our school leaders are very effective at doing that. So giving them the support that they need, addressing fan behavior. We have recently implemented a fan ejection policy. When an official ejects a fan from the stands, they are not allowed to come back for the next contest. And so schools are expected to uphold those standards of excellence.
We're talking with Stephanie Hauser, who leads the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association, as we discuss high school sports, the landscape here in Wisconsin. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Peter in Pewaukee is here. Hi, Peter. What's on your mind?
Yes, Stephanie, does the WIAA have any monitoring system in place for recruitment of athletes by coaches, which obviously is theoretically illegal?
Recruiting athletes by coaches, Stephanie.
Undue influence is not allowed by WIAA member schools. And so, Peter, we rely very heavily on the membership to alert our office when they believe that undue influence has occurred. This office itself does not have an investigative arm. And so we present the situation back to the member school, and the member school investigates the claims that were made. And if indeed it is found that there was undue influence that occurs, there are sanctions outlined in the WIAA constitution that can be subjected to member schools, to the whole school, to the whole athletic program, to a specific program, you know, if it's just one single sport that the violation occurred in. So, yes, there are steps in place to address that.
Are there single sports that stand out to you? I mean, is this a football issue? Is it bigger than that?
I don't think it's a single issue. I think it's probably across the board. I don't know if Peter had a single sport in mind when he was asking the question, but I don't think we see it tied to any one sport.
In terms of wrestling, the state tournament for girls and boys is set for February 22nd to the 24th in Madison. And you say the number of girls participating in high school wrestling is rapidly growing. What is driving this growth?
Well, the WIAA sanctioned the sport of girls wrestling 3 seasons ago, and now our associate director, Mal Dow, leads and oversees that sport, and he has a true passion for that sport. He is working very closely with a small committee of people who are focused very closely on the sport of girls wrestling specifically, doing everything they can to increase the numbers. We've gone from just over 450 in year one, 2 seasons ago, to last year, just over 700. And this year, there are over 1,200 girls wrestling in the high school, at the high school ranks in our state. So it is very exciting. Starting last year, the girls were featured at the state championship at the Cole Center alongside the boys. So that growth is very exciting. We also are seeing some growth in the boys' numbers as well. So overall, just an excitement for the sport of wrestling.
Okay, so you're seeing growth there, growth in volleyball. In our last few moments together, what else can Wisconsin do to, you know, improve high school athletics?
Finding ways to make something accessible to kids, as Lori mentioned, that's important. The number one success factor of kids in high school is just being connected to their school, whether it's through a fine arts program, a club or an activity, whether it's a sporting event. When students are connected, they succeed. They do well. So again, we want to just keep seeking new opportunities for kids to get connected and looking for those new things that excite them. As I mentioned earlier, the launch of Boys and Girls Lacrosse this spring. Again, another new way to connect kids to their high school.
Stephanie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kate. I appreciate it.
Stephanie Hauser is Executive Director of the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.